The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week periodical, and our date of this current issue now, January the 5th of 2022. John Federson, your reader today, and your performer, too. That's right. Management has told me I can triple my income here at the Reading Service by simply playing violin and piano for 2 minutes and 58 seconds. That's the length of this theme music. So I said to myself, well, I'm a trained drummer. How hard could it be? Okay, it's going well so far, but now it's time to get on to the verbal portion of our Indie Week show. And we'll kick right off with Lee Taus, 22 Things to Watch in 2022. It's hard to think about the future when the last year hardly feels like it happened at all. Yet here we are at the very start of a not-quite-palindromic 2022 teeming with uncertainties. If 2021 was defined by a feeling of limbo dangling between the darkest days of a pandemic and a just out-of-reach, virus-free future without lonely holidays, mask mandates, and so much death, what issues are poised to transform and define the next 300-something tomorrows? Prognostication is a dangerous hobby. Even the luckiest mystics run the chance of being wrong. Still, some things about this year are certain. We will still be fighting the pandemic. The legal battle of gerrymandering will continue to play out in the courts. Taller, denser development will cause friction in communities, and there will be an election or two that will certainly cause a lot of drama. Well, suffice it to say, we've done a little thinking about 2022 for you. Here's what we'll be watching. The third year of the pandemic. Last month, the CDC reported that the first case of the Omicron variant on U.S. soil. Now it's everywhere in North Carolina, and it's accounting for the majority of new COVID cases. Add to that the stagnating vaccination rates in adults and the last 2 weeks of holiday travel and gatherings, and we've got a recipe for this new year starting out with a surge in COVID-19 cases. The pandemic isn't going anywhere, at least not yet. Our new normal is now just normal. Gerrymandering. As you read this, a 3-judge panel in Wake County Superior Court is hearing lawsuits challenging heavily gerrymandered district maps for the U.S. Congress and North Carolina legislature. Central to these cases is the question of whether GOP leaders erred in making the maps by ignoring racial data and, in turn, diluting black votes. The judges plan to rule in the case by January the 11th, at which point the state Supreme Court, which leans Democratic, could take it up. Should the election move forward with the current maps, Republicans could capture 11 of 14 congressional seats and have the potential to regain a supermajority in the legislature. If the maps are thrown out, we could be looking at further delays to the election as litigation drags on. 3. Durham's historic gun violence spike. The year 2021 was one of the deadliest in recent history in the Bull City, with a total of 47 homicides. Gun violence has been a mounting problem for Durham, and how to address it will be one of the biggest challenges leaders will face this year. Many of the shootings have been linked to gang violence and recruitment, which explains the involvement of younger teenagers in shootings. Last month, 2 teens were killed and 4 others wounded when the SUV they were traveling in was shot up. Some of the passengers were in middle school. Restaurants revival. This year is poised to be a big one for the recovering restaurant scene, with a slew of hotly anticipated openings. Georgios Bakatsias has 4 projects expected to launch in 22, including a pizza bar, a French bistro, and a Spanish tapas joint, while former Top Chef star Katsui Tanabe plans to open La Verde Cocina and Tequila Bar in Cary. Additionally, Raleigh chef Scott Crawford has a steakhouse in the works for Cary's new Fenton development. The resurrection of restaurants won't be without challenges, as the industry is still facing staffing shortages and financially recovering from forced closures earlier in the pandemic. How restaurateurs overcome those obstacles this year will shape the industry for years to come. 5. Commuter rail plans taking shape. Will the Triangle finally get commuter rail? The dream of workers avoiding a bumper-to-bumper morning drive on I-40 is starting to take shape as Go Triangle plots a transit line connecting Durham to Raleigh and either Clayton or Garner. The project will cost up to $2 billion just to plan, and while federal funds will likely cover half the expense, taxpayers will shoulder the remaining cost. But if plans move forward, construction on a rail system could begin as early as 2025. This isn't the Triangle's first go-round on this track. Planners spent more than a decade concocting another rail plan before abandoning it in 2006 when federal funding wasn't made available. And we all remember what happened to Durham Chapel Hill light rail plans in 2019. 6. The national fight to protect abortion rights. After the Supreme Court punted a Texas law banning nearly all abortions in the state back to lower courts, shaking that precedent set by landmark case Roe v. Wade, the nation's preparing to wage a state-by-state legal battle over abortion rights in the years to come. Should Roe v. Wade be overturned, we'll likely see a flurry of conservative-led states enacting similar abortion bans. Unless the dynamic of the court shifts dramatically, women face the very real possibility of losing legal control over their own bodies. It's a nightmare scenario. There's not much more to say. 7. Chapel Hill's new town council. After a slate of pro-growth candidates swept the election last year, the Chapel Hill Town Council looks very different in 2022. The local NIMBY advocacy group, CHALT, Chapel Hill Association for a Livable Town, is unlikely to remain a dominant voice in local politics any longer. When it comes to questions of development, the new council will likely prioritize denser, taller projects in the town's core. The Raleigh Parks Bond. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin wants to finish what she started in 2019 when voters overwhelmingly passed an $80 million affordable housing bond. Now, the Raleigh City Council is eyeing a hefty parks package to kickstart the Dix Park redevelopment and revamp the city's greenways. The council decided to forego the bond in 2020, facing the economic fallout from the pandemic. On a lengthy ballot, the bond potentially topping $100 million will be a big ask from voters, and it will be on the current council to sell it, while also campaigning to hold on to their seats. The primary is 9. Campaign filing for the 2022 March primary had already begun when courts ruled to postpone that election until this May. Meanwhile, a dense field of hotly contested races is already narrowing. Key races, including the Wake County District Attorney's race and a new congressional district encompassing Durham and Chapel Hill, will likely be determined in the primary. But whether the primary actually happens in May is up to the courts to decide as they weigh a new set of gerrymandering lawsuits challenging the legality of the recently redrawn district maps. 10. Infrastructure funding. Although President Joe Biden's Build Back Better bill has faced pushback from Republican leaders and a certain Democrat or two, his recently passed $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure package means significant federal funding will trickle down to the local level for much-needed improvements. In North Carolina, that means money for transit, bridges, and broadband. Hopefully, local leaders will put that cash to good use. The housing bubble. The Triangle's housing scene was already red hot when the pandemic descended and more folks decided North Carolina was the place to be. Now it's pretty much nuclear, with homes under $300,000 flying off the market as soon as they're listed or somehow even snapped up before. In the last year, housing prices have shot up thanks to an influx of out-of-state buyers and a limited supply. Unless the economy completely collapses, expect that trend to continue this year. 12. The drama at UNC Chapel Hill. between the university's botched hiring of renowned journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones and the continued questions about the political influence of the conservative-leaning Board of Governors on the university's academic agenda, 2021 was a tumultuous year for UNC Chapel Hill. A recent report revealed that 9 of the school's top academic leaders have left the university since May, and squabbles over Chris Clemens' appointment as the new provost, a strong conservative voice, it's been noted, likely won't help matters. Unless concessions are made and business is conducted a bit more transparently, 2022 could see more controversy and turnover at the university as tensions continue to flare. 13. Downtown South. With a rezoning granted, plans for John Cain's ambitious Downtown South in Raleigh are expected to move forward next year, albeit without a soccer stadium as originally planned. The new commercial and residential hub could revitalize the former industrial area south of the city center, but opponents believe it will also fuel gentrification in the area, home to some of the last remaining affordable neighborhoods in Raleigh. 14. Mayor Elaine O'Neill. In the fall, Durham voters elected the city's first black woman mayor, Elaine O'Neill. She entered office as the city faces an uptick in gun violence, and she has vowed to put an end to it through programs aiming to mentor young people and provide a living wage employment. But it remains to be seen if such programs will be enough to curb the violence, or whether current trends will continue to haunt the Bull City in 2022. 15. Schools continuing to adapt. Another year with COVID will mean another year of headaches for local school boards caught between a rock and a hard place when it comes to balancing education and public safety. With children age 5 and older now eligible for vaccination, we hopefully won't see a return to remote learning. But schools will need to continue to innovate around the pandemic while facing scrutiny from parents on both sides of the debate. 16. The Green Tract in Chapel Hill. One of the most heated battles in Orange County has been the debate over this jointly owned parcel of land that was used as a landfill for 4 decades before it was shut down in 2013. Recently, local leaders voted to preserve 60 acres with a permanent conservation easement, with another 100 acres potentially available for future development and affordable housing. No doubt, future development plans will face vehement opposition from a certain subset of conservation and neighborhood advocates that fared poorly in the last election. 17. Separated bus lanes in Raleigh. While commuter rail may still very much be a dream, separated bus lanes in Raleigh are getting closer to becoming a reality. Infrastructure improvements and exclusive lanes for bus rapid transit are in the works for the New Bern Avenue corridor connecting Wake Med Hospital to downtown, a key commuting route that could significantly boost ridership and get more cars off the road. 18. The midterm election. 2 years into President Joe Biden's term and with post-census redistricting in play, the 22 midterms will have massive implications for state and local politics. Midterm elections typically don't go well for the party controlling the White House, and the threat of a red wave bringing back a Republican legislative supermajority in North Carolina, plus a majority in the U.S. House and Senate, and all the mayhem that entails is very real. If Democrats lose the legal battle over gerrymandering, they'll need a substantial voter drive to stave off Republican gains and hold on to what little power they have in North Carolina and in Washington. 19. Criminal justice reforms. During the first half of her term as Durham District Attorney, Satana DeBerry made big strides in reforming the city's justice system, including ending the cash bail system and expunging millions in unpaid traffic fines and other charges. We hope DeBerry persists with her progressive agenda in 22, and with Wake County District Attorney Lauren Freeman facing a formidable challenge in the Democratic primary, it will be interesting to see if some reforms trickle down to Wake County as well. Number 20, staggering Raleigh elections, lengthening terms and paying the mayor and council members more. Amongst the Rawl poll's hottest issues, the debates over the city council's term limits, increased pay, or staggered elections. The current council's detractors will frame any change as a blatant power grab, but it's more complicated than that. Increasing pay could open the door to more diverse representation, something Raleigh has needed desperately for some time. Number 21, working from home. This year, companies that pushed employees to return to the workplace en masse faced backlash from workers now accustomed to the benefits of working from home. How industries grapple with managing the balance between productivity and presence will reshape work as we know it, and the companies that are the most successful will find creative ways to foster a positive workplace culture outside of endless Zoom meetings and break room ping pong tables. That said, remote work is still very much a luxury in a labor market dominated by lower-paying service jobs. That dynamic unlikely to shift much in 2022. Finally, number 22, tech scene growth. If there's one industry that wasn't crippled by the pandemic, it's the local tech scene. Raleigh-based voice over IP monopoly Bandwidth has already been begun construction on a massive half-million square foot complex off of Reedy Creek Road, and it feels like every day a new company moves into RTP. While companies like Citrix have experienced layoffs and there are rumblings of the sale of the Raleigh software company in the works, trends are mostly looking positive for the industry, setting the stage for 2022 to be another year of innovation and growth. Next, from Durham and Tomasi McDonald, new suit. Duke University is in hot water, legally speaking, once again. Late last month, a longtime Duke physician and School of Medicine faculty member filed a complaint against his employer, accusing university officials of conspiring to take over a for-profit doctor and faculty-owned clinic that generates revenues of about $1 billion each year. At the center of the complaint is the continued existence of the Private Diagnostic Clinic, PDC, an independent company controlled by physicians and one of the first faculty private physician groups in the United States. The complaint claims the university has conspired with certain PDC managers to dissolve the PDC and is attempting to hire PDC members to work with the School of Medicine's newly formed Duke Faculty Practice, DFP. The complaint was filed on December 20th on behalf of the PDC by Eugene Moretti, an anesthesiologist and critical care specialist who has been a member of the private medical practice for over 20 years. With billions of dollars at stake, the complaint filed in Durham County Superior Court claims that Duke health administrators are attempting to take control of the lucrative medical practice for, quote, $0 if offer of employment with the DFP is, quote, accepted by all or substantially all of PDC's physicians, unquote. Joseph Lynch, an attorney with a New York firm, which was retained by the PDC board to evaluate Duke's plan to take over the PDC, says, it seems clear that one of Duke's overarching objectives here is to terminate PDC by taking over substantially all of the assets and operations. In my more than 35 years as a health law attorney, I've never seen a physician practice like PDC transferred to any acquirer at a $0 purchase price, Lynch also stated in a memo to the board. A Duke University official last week told the Indy that Moretti's lawsuit, quote, has no basis in fact or law, and the university will offer a vigorous defense in response. Michael Schoenfeld, a Duke spokesman, said, for a number of months, Duke and the PDC, quote, have been engaged in productive dialogue around alignment of our respective patient care, teaching, and research missions. He told the Indy in an email, Duke has proposed that faculty physicians who are already employed by Duke for education and research become full-time Duke employees for their clinical practice as well. We believe this will lead to a greater operational efficiency, better patient experience, the ability to recruit and retain top talent, and enhancement in community health. The lawsuit filed by Dr. Moretti, who is not a representative of PDC leadership, is an attempt to obstruct these discussions about alignment and impede Duke's ability to provide the highest quality health care services to our patients. In the complaint, Moretti claims that after repeatedly failing to gain control and ultimately dissolve the PDC, Duke is now resorting to unlawful, unfair, and improper tactics to destroy the company and take over its business and goodwill. The PDC was founded in 1931 as an independent, for-profit group practice, quote, that has a long relationship with Duke Hospital and the university. From the onset, the PDC was self-governed and not subject to university direction, said the complaint. All PDC members hold academic appointments to the faculty at Duke, and its 1,850 member physicians treat nearly 2 million patients each year at nearly 150 clinics across North Carolina and Virginia. The private faculty member practice also, quote, contributes over $60 million annually to Duke University for medical center research and academics, unquote, which is money that supports hiring faculty, running research programs, and contributing to the growth of School of Medicine and DUHS, according to the complaint. Duke and the PDC were months away from celebrating the anniversary of a 1972 partnership agreement that provided a structure in which the members can engage in the private practice of medicine and dentistry for private gains while retaining their academic relationship with Duke University, according to that agreement. In October, however, Eugene Washington, Duke's Chancellor for Health Affairs and President CEO of Duke University Health System, terminated the partnership agreement, says the complaint. Moretti states that Washington wrote in the termination letter that Duke nonetheless looked forward to continuing its work with the PDC, quote, in a cooperative manner consistent with our shared goals. As we move forward, I want to make it clear we have no intention of taking steps to undermine the PDC or compromise its continued existence. We have no intention to disrupt, create economic disadvantages for, or otherwise adversely impact physicians who choose to remain members of the PDC and continue their practice in that structure. But Moretti said the words of Duke's administrators are directly at odds with their actions. Erica Harris, an attorney with Houston-based firm Sussman Godfrey, is among the lawyers representing Moretti. Harris told the Indy last week that Mary E. Klotman, dean of Duke Medical School, is, quote, the public face of the takeover. In the complaint, Moretti asserts that Klotman has the power to hire, fire, demote, and promote the department chairs, and their careers are advanced by staying in the dean's good graces. That's a problem, he asserts, because some managers of the PDC, who are also department chairs, have proved unable to make decisions that are in the best interest of the PDC. The 39-page complaint outlines a series of actions that began in August to dissolve the practice. Moretti states that Duke administrators created a pretext to explain why the school decided, quote, to interfere with and take over the PDC business, and issued a mandate stating that physicians who perform research at Duke must quit the PDC and join the university-controlled Duke faculty practice. The pretext Duke used to justify the mandate was, quote, regulatory and compliance risks from the National Institutes of Health, according to the complaint. Harris, the attorney, told the Indy that Duke has not provided a satisfactory answer showing how the PDC is out of compliance with the National Institutes of Health. We have asked Duke to show us the regulations. We don't believe there are any such regulations. By the summer of 2021, Moretti stated the Duke revealed its true goal to force the dissolution when Klotman, along with five department chairs with the School of Medicine, began lobbying the physician members of the PDC to vote to dissolve the company. Moretti also accused the PDC's own board of failing to respond adequately to Duke's efforts to destroy the PDC. In the light of Duke's and PDC board's lack of transparency, certain PDC members created a message board to anonymously share information and opinions on Duke's attempted takeover. Moretti states, the message board allowed the physicians to remain anonymous because they feared retaliation for publicly opposing Duke's takeover. Moretti points to a February 21 email from Klotman that announced the School of Medicine, with support from Duke Health and Duke University leadership, would create the DFP, which would take over the PDC's business and operations. The email contained the unsettling caveat that, quote, all faculty in clinical departments who perform research must be fully employed by the School of Medicine in the DFP prior to July of 2022. The complaint states the PDC could lose hundreds of physician members and hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue if the departments of medicine, psychiatry, neurology, orthopedic, obstetrics, and gynecology exit the PDC to join a Duke-controlled entity. More than 1,000 PDC physicians who participated in a survey opposed the takeover, according to the complaint. And in late November, a committee of 11 at-large members appointed by the PDC board issued a report that unanimously concluded that claims raised by Dr. Moretti are not baseless and have merit. Moretti demands a jury trial in the complaint, which lists Duke University, the health system, and former PDC board member Anthony Joseph Vieira, chair of the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health, as defendants. The PDC is listed on the complaint as a nominal defendant, particularly the company's board members who, like Vieira, chair departments at Duke University Medical School and within PDC. Harris says the PDC managers who are cooperating and conspiring with Duke to enforce the takeover are doing it out of, quote, self-interest, not in the interest of the PDC. Next, originally published in North Carolina Policy Watch Journal, low grade. Fights over mask mandates and critical race theory characterized the discourse around public education last year. And with midterms in the fall, writes Greg Childress, we're likely on track for more of the same. Critical race theory, CRT, and face mask mandates dominated the education headlines in 2021, even as students and teachers struggled to recover from a year of remote learning that saw standardized test scores fall to new lows. Racial and economic inequities in education exposed by the pandemic were quickly shoved to the background by a loud minority of irate parents who complained that school boards were trashing their rights by forcing students to wear face coverings to slow the spread of the highly transmissible COVID virus. Disparities in high-speed internet connections and school funding shined an unflattering light on the inequity of resources found in many of the state's low-wealth rural districts. In Buncombe County, the school district's face mask mandate so angered a group of parents they attempted to take over the school board. The faux coup soon became one of the lowlights of the pandemic. The unruly crowd forced the Board of Education to call a recess. Members of the audience then purported to nominate and appoint themselves to the board. In Greensboro, the Guilford County Board of Education and Superintendent Sharon Contreras received threats due to the face mask mandate. The board increased security at school board meetings and for the superintendent. NC Policy Watch reported on the concerted effort in North Carolina by right-leaning political operatives to use face mask mandates and CRT as wedge issues to turn this year's local elections and the midterms in the GOP's favor. The strategy worked to perfection in Virginia, where Republican Glenn Youngkin, a political newcomer, defeated Democrat Terry McAuliffe, a former governor, in a tightly contested governor's race in which Youngkin's opposition to CRT became a winning issue. Most educators say CRT, an academic discipline that examines how racism has shaped American law and public policy, is not taught in K-12 classrooms. Nonetheless, after Youngkin's victory, North Carolina Superintendent of Public Instruction, Catherine Truitt, shared a celebratory tweet and vowed to fight for the same principles as Youngkin. During tours of North Carolina's Republican stronghold this year, Truitt promised the GOP faithful that she'd fight to remove CRT from classrooms. As your superintendent, she said, during a June meet and greet with Orange County Republicans, I will continue to do everything I can to stop CRT and eradicate it from classrooms. Republicans in North Carolina are united on this. The fact that educators say it's not taught in K-12 schools didn't stop North Carolina's Republican-led General Assembly from approving House Bill 324 to restrict what students could be taught about the nation's racial history. Nor did it stop parents, mostly white, but also some black, from appearing at local school board meetings to complain that their children are being indoctrinated with CRT. When pressed to explain CRT, however, most could not. Many of them contend CRT teaches young, impressionable students that America and white people are inherently and irredeemably racist. But critics of HB 324 and other such legislation adopted across the nation argue it's important that children learn hard truths about American racism and that historically the nation has been imperfect in its treatment of blacks and other people of color. HB 324 included 13 concepts teachers would be prohibited from promoting in North Carolina classroom. The concept that, quote, one race or sex is inherently superior to another race or sex, and that an individual solely by virtue of race or sex is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, were amongst the prohibited topics. Governor Cooper, a Democrat, vetoed the bill. He said the debate about CRT distracted lawmakers from the serious work of supporting educators and students during a global pandemic that has challenged educators and students. The legislature should be focused on supporting teachers, helping students recover lost learning, and investing in our schools, Cooper said in a statement. Instead, this bill pushes calculated, conspiracy-laden politics into public education. Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, a Republican from Greensboro, and the state's first black lieutenant governor, and state Senate leader Phil Berger, who is from Rockingham, were outspoken in their opposition to CRT. Berger said, I oppose it, and I will combat it with everything that I have, because I believe the doctrine undoes the framework that produced the most successful ongoing experiment in self-government in the history of mankind. Meanwhile, Robinson, unhappy about the State Board of Education's adoption of new social studies standards, which he claims are infused with CRT, launched the Fairness and Accountability in the Classroom for Teachers and Students, FACTS, task force to give students, teachers, and parents a tool to report perceived cases of bias or indoctrination in public schools. Charlotte educator Justin Parmenter reviewed more than 500 of the comments submitted to the task force, however, and found many of them critical of Robinson for conducting a, quote, shameful political witch hunt. The state's long-running school funding lawsuit emerged as a top topic late in the year as lawmakers began budget negotiations. The big question? How much of $5.6 billion in new school improvement funding recommended by a private consultant over the next 8 years would be included in the 21-22 budget? The first 2 years of the school improvement plan call for $1.7 billion in new education dollars. The newly elected state budget, however, funds just 53% of the school improvement plan and falls to 43% next year, according to Chris Nordstrom, a senior policy analyst at the North Carolina Justice Center and Law Project. Note, Policy Watch is a project of this Justice Center. Governor Cooper said the state, with more than $6 billion in reserves, had a once-in-a-generation opportunity to transform and strengthen public schools. It was not to be. Despite Superior Court Judge David Lee's order to lawmakers to fully fund the plan, the state's Republican leadership resisted. The case is now tangled up in court after the State Court of Appeals blocked Lee's orders, ruling the judge doesn't have the authority to order the state to transfer $1.7 billion from its rainy day account to fund those first 2 years of the 8-year school improvement plan. The appeals court ruling doesn't impact Lee's finding that the funding he ordered is needed to help the state meet its constitutional obligation to provide the children of the state with sound basic education. Lee had ordered several North Carolina officials, Treasurer Falwell, Controller Linda Combs, and Budget Director Charles Peruse, to release state money to fund the first 2 years of a statewide school improvement plan. The school funding issue will likely be resolved by the state Supreme Court, which would be asked to determine whether Lee has the authority to order the legislature to fund the Leandro Plan. That case began more than 25 years ago after 5 rural school districts in low-wealth counties sued the state, arguing they couldn't raise the tax revenue needed to provide students with a quality education. In 1997, the state Supreme Court issued a ruling, reconfirmed in 2004, which held every child has a right to a sound basic education that includes competent and well-trained teachers and principals and equitable access to resources. The new year will likely bring more of the same on the education front as Democrats and Republicans square off in the midterm elections, look for more friction over CRT, and face mask mandates as the Omicron variant becomes the dominant strain of the COVID virus. Lawmakers will also continue contentious debates over school funding and whether Judge Lee has the authority to order the General Assembly to meet its constitutional mandate to provide North Carolina children with sound basic education. Now, health news from North Carolina, and this has a byline, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 separate reporters and journalists contributed to this article called Health in the Year Ahead. This could be the year that the coronavirus subsides. However, as 21 bleeds into 22, with the Omicron variant sending case numbers soaring and hospitalizations on a steep incline, the new year starts out much like last year. COVID will continue to play a large role in public health care and policies shaping the state's virus attack and potential recovery plans. It should become clear in the first couple of weeks of 2022 whether Omicron will take the same, less intense course in this country as it did in South Africa and Scotland, according to 2 preliminary studies. Or is there more ambiguity about the severity of illness and potential for dangerously strained health care systems caused by the variant, as an English study suggests? Cody Kinsley, who became acting secretary of the State Department of Health and Human Services on January the 1st, will be leading the pandemic in response, taking over from Mandy Cohen, who resigned from her job at the end of December to try something new. What that something new is will likely become clear in 2022 and reveal whether it will occur in North Carolina or elsewhere. Kinsley will pick up the baton in the now years-long race against COVID, even as testing sites are swamped in the post-holiday crush of people trying to get tested before or after gatherings. He also will be taking the lead as a push for new COVID therapies and treatments become stronger. The federal government has promised to make more home tests available in the weeks ahead, but whether the supply will match the demand is another unknown. And some experts say these newly available tests will come too late to avoid a flood of Omicron cases. Vaccination against COVID and booster shots are likely to be key refrains from North Carolina public health advocates in an effort to relieve the state from the throes of a virus that has shown its adaptability. Though many hoped COVID vaccines would be available early in 2022 for children ages at least 6 months to 4 years old, Pfizer announced in mid-December that further study was needed to test the efficacy of a 3-dose, 3-microgram series before seeking authorization for emergency use. Clinical trial data suggested that 2 doses of that vaccine provided a robust response of antibodies in children younger than 2. But for those from 2 to 4, the dose was likely too small to produce as strong a response as was achieved for teens and young adults. The setback could mean that vaccines for toddlers and preschool children won't be available until at least the second quarter of the year. The number of COVID cases in children rose sharply in 2021, and as the Omicron variant moves so swiftly through unvaccinated populations, there are concerns about long-term effects of the virus on children, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. The past fortnight brought more pediatric deaths from COVID than at any other time during the entire pandemic. Another question that will be explored as it goes on is whether children, teachers, and other school staff can stay safely in classrooms with a test-to-stay approach. As the new year starts, we will continue to track and answer those and other questions about COVID and how long it will continue to menace North Carolinians in the months ahead. That was Ann Blythe's contribution. Clarissa Donnelly DeRoven says changes to the state's largest insurance provider. Everyone expected issues to crop up during the initial transition to Medicaid managed care. Now we're 6 months into the switch, and those in charge have had some time to learn about and address the most pressing issues. North Carolina Health News will be keeping an eye out for problems that persist, including potential billing and reimbursement issues and rate cuts. Getting into the weeds of how these programs are administered can be dull, but when these intricate systems become harder to navigate, the people who suffer are North Carolina's low-income residents, primarily children. NC Health News will also be keeping a close watch on the Healthy Opportunities Pilot, a first-of-its-kind state initiative that aims to save money on medical spending by investing $650 million in projects to address social determinants of health, such as access to food, transportation, and housing. Finally, in their final budget document, state legislators created a combined House and Senate Committee on Access to Care and Medicaid Expansion, quote, to consider various ways in which access to health care and insurance can be improved for North Carolinians. That committee will start its work in the first quarter of 2022. Now she provides another segment, changes to care for the whole person. There's a million and one things to dig into regarding rural health, but two in particular are integrated care clinics and traveling clinics. It's no secret that rural areas often lack specialty providers and sometimes even basic health clinics. Throughout the pandemic, traveling clinics have provided vaccines and COVID tests to areas that needed them. NC Health News plans to follow providers who are using this model to bring different types of primary care, such as dental and vision, to areas that lack them, such as farm worker camps. Integrated care clinics are also a creative solution to some of these health care desert woes. The providers at these clinics address patient health in a holistic way, looking at the relationship between physical and mental health and aiming to address both simultaneously. Next, by Elizabeth Thompson, dueling public health crises in the prisons and jails. As 21 came to an end, two things were very clear. Both the opioid crisis and the pandemic are not going anytime soon. There are two issues that disproportionately impact people who are incarcerated or formerly incarcerated. With the Omicron variant spreading quickly in the United States, the state's prison and jail response will be crucial to saving lives. Over 70% of people incarcerated in the state's prison are fully vaccinated, but experts have urged that it might not be enough. If you were vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson two months ago, or either Moderna or Pfizer vaccine more than 6 months ago. About 11% of people incarcerated in the state prison had elected to get a booster as of December 14th, according to the Department of Public Safety. Prison staff vaccination rates continue to lag behind those of people who are incarcerated across the country. In jails, where staff and detainees are constantly cycling in and out, it's very difficult to keep track of who is vaccinated and boosted. Jails and prisons are also dealing with the opioid epidemic. Around 85% of people in prison have an active substance use disorder or were incarcerated for a crime involving drugs. 85%. Still, treatment for substance use disorder is not widespread throughout the prisons and inconsistent in the jails. The prisons are set to start a pilot program to expand medication-assisted treatment in some facilities. How well that works could have wide-ranging implications for how the prison system as a whole treats substance use disorders. How about environmental issues? Water quality issues will continue to be a top concern as the extent of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAs, and other industrial pollutant contamination is becoming clearer. Both the state budget and the federal bipartisan infrastructure bill have set aside funding to examine PFAs and other water contamination issues. North Carolina Health News is looking to dig deeper into some environmental issues that have languished for, at times, generations. One of those issues is contamination in Baden Lake, a dammed reservoir on the Yadkin Pedee River. In the past, industrial plants, in particular an Alcoa smelter, left the water contaminated. In December, the national organization ProPublica published detailed maps of cancer hotspots across the United States that largely affect communities of color. Some of those are in North Carolina, and NC Health News plans to dig into that data as the year progresses with the hiring of a new environmental health reporter. The second year of the state budget biennium. General Assembly wrapped up the 21 work session in December, making that the longest legislative session in close to three decades. In November, Republican lawmakers and Governor Cooper reached an agreement over a budget which was packed with earmarks, funded largely by federal COVID relief appropriations. Part of that budget included a provision to create a select committee on Medicaid expansion, a policy move that's been at the top of Democrats' wish lists for close to a decade. As that process ramps up in the first quarter of 22, we'll be keeping close tabs on lawmakers' deliberations around the policy, which, after many years, received an endorsement from Senate leader Phil Berger. Even-number years typically have shorter legislative sessions, which traditionally have focused on revising the state budget for the second year. But other even-number of years have resulted in plenty of policy and spending changes. NC Health News will be back on site at the legislature, keeping track of this process and several study committees, including studies of algal blooms, PFAs and contamination in the state's waterways, and direct care worker salaries, and covering what's likely to be a fight over the coming year's state budget now that most of those federal COVID dollars have been appropriated. And the state's response to mental health services in crisis. There's no doubt the pandemic sparked a mental health crisis as people suffered through immeasurable stress and loss. North Carolina hospital leaders have sounded the alarm, saying we're in a behavioral health emergency as the increasing number of patients are coming to emergency departments in distress. Experts say the peak of a mental health crisis hits about 6 months after disaster, such as a hurricane, but this one is different. The pandemic has dragged on for nearly 2 years, presenting new challenges, and it isn't over yet. We expect a pandemic-induced mental health crisis to outlive the virus and be the key focus of our reporting in the coming year, particularly for young people. In the fall, Mental Health America's 21 report ranked North Carolina 45th overall for pediatric mental health care. Then in early December, U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a 50-page advisory calling urgent attention to the issue of adolescent mental health. The document came with a note saying the Surgeon General advisories are reserved for significant public health challenges that need the nation's immediate awareness and action. Murthy noted the number of high schoolers reporting feelings of loneliness and sadness increased 40% between 2009 and 2019, before the pandemic even began. He described the many factors that contribute, including social media and slow progress on issues like racial justice, climate change, and gun violence. Murthy wrote all that was true even before the pandemic dramatically altered young people's experiences at home, school, and in the community. The pandemic era's unfathomable number of deaths, pervasive sense of fear, economic instability, and forced physical distancing from loved ones, friends, and communities have exacerbated the unprecedented stresses young people already faced. In June of 21, it was estimated that more than 140,000 children across the country had lost a parent or grandparent caregiver to COVID, according to the advisory. It also cites emergency department data that shows higher rates of youth suicide attempts, particularly among young women, during the pandemic. Murthy wrote, "It would be a tragedy if we beat back one public health crisis only to allow another to grow in its place." The Surgeon General's advisory lists several different action steps for health professionals, educators, community members, families, and young people to improve the mental health of adolescents, which range from raising awareness to improving access to care. And finally, challenge and opportunities with the growing share of older Tar Heels. They continue to compose an increasing sector of North Carolina's population, 16.7%, or almost one out of every six, according to census estimates. Way back in 2010, the share of North Carolinians aged 65 and older was 12.9%. That means older people's piece of the population grew by about 30% in a little more than a decade. It also means that the state will need many more independent living apartments, caregivers, geriatricians, and home health workers. And it will benefit from the brain trust and energy apparent in many seniors. In 2021, those numbers surely played into what's called the most positive legislative session in years for older people, including some recurring state funding for sources of help like Meals on Wheels and transportation. But as always, there's competition for official attention and the money that comes along with it, given additional needs such as school funding, continuing COVID response, and a recent increase in disaster relief. As executive director of the North Carolina Coalition on Aging, Heather Burkhart keeps up with news and reports from government agencies, nonprofit groups, and businesses with a stake in the health and welfare of older people. Advocates have said that a key to better outcomes for this group lies in better wages and treatment for the state's direct care workers, a focus of the coalition that should show results in 2022. Burkhart said on December 3rd at a statewide gathering of leaders, "It's been a cornerstone of the work we've done over this last year. We've really focused our energies on wages and collaborations, not just within aging, but across all service industries." Members will push in 2022 for a state study on the aging boom to look comprehensively at the generation's specific problems, solutions, and opportunities, some of which may not reveal themselves at first glance. And he said, "The state needs a roadmap of how to address the implications of an aging baby boomer population." Well, this info-packed issue of Indie Week has reached its 4 minutes to go mark, and I believe that I will move over to the online IndieWeek.com for an article or two. Particularly, we'll start with this music review. The Lemon Sparks have released an album called Rain Cloud in the Sun. It's their second release, and Eddie Huffman for the Indie Week says, "It's power pop with a dark edge." Jeff Carroll has shown up in album credits for years, but more for his technical expertise than for his own music. He's mastered records by Mandolin Orange, Ron Sexsmith, Six String, Drag, and I Was Totally Destroying It. But every few years he steps away from his Mac, straps on a Gibson, and spouts a new batch of finely crafted power pop songs. Rain Cloud in the Sun is the latest by Lemon Sparks, Carroll's trio, that released its self-titled debut back in 2015. Lemon Sparks showcased original Carroll songs for the first time in 15 years, making up for lost time while mining rock history. The album split the difference between the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds and Big Star's number one record, melding quirky ambience and crunchy guitars. The group tied it all together with gorgeous melodies, heartfelt lyrics, and a jumped-up cover of Big Star's 13. At the time, Lemon Sparks joined a run of sophisticated Wrecking Crew-worthy pop records from Triangle Artists alongside Up in the Air by Brett Harris, Oleander by Skylar Goudash, I Still Look for You by Anne Claire, New Songs for the 20th Century by Chris Stamey, and Peter Holsapple's Game Day. 6 years later, Rain Cloud in the Sun picks up where the debut album left off and returns with a darker edge better suited to the pandemic era. Carroll sings, "Don't call me if you're bleeding in the night. I won't be there in the right ways." Gone is the bubbly mood of songs like Carl Wilson's War and Digging Up Flowers, replaced by the bittersweet melancholy of When You Close Your Eyes and Ellie. Carroll's textured, understated vocals convey both moods equally well. Every member of the group contributes to the new album's dense layers. Drummer and percussionist Greg Turian also sings backup. So does the bassist Rick Lassiter, who adds a guitar, keys, and strings. Lassiter contributes a song for the first time, the wistful Rem-ish Canyon. Guest musicians include Don Kerr, a longtime Sexsmith sideman and Holsapple, who plays Hammond organ on the soaring, spoon-like title track. Well, and speaking of music, I've been told if I want to triple my income, I better pick up the piano and violin and get to playing our theme music. This broadcast of Indie Week will be found at ncreadingservice.org in our podcast section for the foreseeable future. But if you want to hear segments of it again, just go to that website, ncreadingservice.com. John Fetterson waiting for his mammoth salary increase and finishing up on the piano and violin for you. So long for this week.